Our third speaker this morning is Brother Jim Stiles. His topic for the week is Ezra, Working Together in the Last Days. And his topic today is Don't Give Up When Things Go Wrong. Brother Jim.
Well, good morning, everyone. Still wide awake and ready to roll. Our goal today is to get through the foundation of the temple and the beginning of the building of the temple and have a look at some of the issues that developed and hopefully get some good lessons for us to take home from this. You think it would be an exciting time. They're beginning to get everything together. They've got the altar built and they begin to lay the foundation of the temple. We're in Ezra chapter 3. Ezra 3. And I'm just going to lay the notes out on that box over there every day, so if you want to help yourself with a copy when you come in, that's good. And if anybody wants copies of notes from other days, I see they're sitting up here on the table, so that's a good place to pick up the extras. Oh, Brother Bob just took them all, so. Ezra 3. Down around verse 8, in the second month of the second year to their coming of the house of God at Jerusalem, then Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the priests and the Levites, they all begin the work. And the appointed priests and the Levites from 20 years old and upward to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. So finally, they're back in the land. All the preparation that they've done, they're ready to go. And they begin to lay the foundation of the temple. This is when it all begins to start. A couple of things that come up in this. You'll notice that the Levites, it does say about the Levites that they appointed the Levites from 20 years old and above to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. Now, that's a little indication to us, because it mentions that the Levites began at 20 years old and up, that they're following David's directions. And it's just nice to know that when you start looking back to the history of Israel, you wonder, like, when they went up into captivity, what part of the Bible did they really have with them? When they come back down in the land, what kind of the law, what kind of the copies of the scriptures did they have? Well, in the original, under the times of Moses, back in Numbers 8 and verse 24, you find that the Levites didn't begin working until 25 years old and up. The fact that they're now beginning to 20 years old and up is an indication that they were following David's directions, because David had changed the time for the Levites. And it's possible that the reason he changed that time is because once the temple was built and fixed and they weren't transporting around anymore, that it was an easier time for those that were 20 years old and upward to begin the work as opposed to waiting until they were 25. And they didn't have so much of the responsibility of carrying around the things and making sure that they didn't mess up when they were carrying around the parts of the tabernacle as some of the mistakes had been made earlier on. So David changed the rules to 20 years old and upward, and now that's what they're following. Good lesson, though, for those of us that are younger around here. We got any 20-year-olds out there in the audience? 20-year-olds? See, we've got a few around. 20 years old and upwards, according to what David laid out in the Bible, that is an age in which we can begin taking on some tremendous responsibilities. These Levites had a lot of authority in overseeing the work of the house of the Lord. They had to know their Bibles to know what they were supposed to do. When people would come in and they were doing their offerings, these Levites had a tremendous amount of responsibility that was laid upon their shoulders. And at 20 years old, they were ready to begin doing that work. And it's a good reminder to our young people that we don't just need to sit around in ecclesial life until we're 22 and 25 and 30 and just think, well, mom and dad and grandpa and grandma and aunt and uncle will do all the work. 20 years old and up, they were already ready to get involved in the work of the house of God. And it's also a good reminder on the flip side that as we get older in ecclesial life, those of us that are involved in doing things in ecclesial life, we have to make room for the young people that are 20 years old and up to have responsibilities, to have some freedom to do some things in ecclesial life. Sometimes in ecclesias that are well and established and they have a lot of members, what can happen over time is we get used to doing jobs in ecclesial life, and as time goes on, we get more jobs and more jobs and more jobs, and we just keep doing them as we get older. And then the younger people come along and they look around and they say, well, what is there for us to do? It looks like the older folks are doing it all. And there are times where as older folks, we have to purposely make room, either begin new activities or take our names off of some of the things that we've been doing and allow the younger people to get involved in ecclesial life. And that was an important thing to do for all ecclesias, really. And you can see that happening at this time right here, that the younger people, it was a great opportunity to get involved as they were just beginning the work of the house of God. You'll notice in verses 10 and 11 that when they give the directions as to what they did, the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord. The priests stood in their apparel with the trumpets. The Levites, the sons of Asaph, with the cymbals to praise the Lord, according to the ordinance of David of Israel, David, king of Israel. So they were following David's rules. They must have had copies of the things that David did in establishing how they were going to build that temple, and they tried to reenact that at this time period. I mean, that's what we try to do. When we try to look at things, that how are we going to do this? How are we going to solve this problem? How are we going to get going on this activity? We look back in the archives of, well, how did Bible characters do it? Or how did people do it in ecclesial life before? And we try to learn from their experience. And that's exactly what they did here in the case of following the ordinances of David. And in verse 11, they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord. And there's that quote, "For he is good, for his mercy endures forever towards Israel." And that's a passage that's pulled right out of when David brought the ark. In 1 Chronicles chapter 16 at verse 34, that's what they were singing when he brought the ark in, that they praise to God, "For he is good, for his mercy endures forever." And here they threw in the little phrase, "towards Israel." Solomon also used the same phrase in 2 Chronicles 5 and verse 13 when he brought the ark into the temple. You know, you look at it, it's a little phrase. It's just a little verse. But when you're praising God, "for he is good," but it says a lot, because what it's acknowledging, that God is the one who is good and has given us all these things, and it's not because we deserve them, it's because his mercy is great towards us. And that's a key issue to remember in family life and ecclesial life. That's how we never get into, like Brother Des was talking about, the proud look and all these problems, the things that God hates. If we keep our perspectives right, that God is the one who is good, and it's only in his mercy and his grace and his kindness that he allows us to do these things that we don't deserve to do in and of ourselves, we'll never lose that perspective of recognizing, as Brother Des says, it's God's ecclesia. It's not mine. It's not our ecclesia. It's God's ecclesia. They're God's children. They're God's people. And he simply gives us the privilege of working with his children, working with his people in this day and age until the kingdom comes. And so the people, they shouted with a great shout. You can see at the end of verse 11, you can imagine the excitement. They're laying the foundations, and all they're doing really is getting the outline of how big the temple is going to be. They're laying the foundation. The people are singing. There's this great shout. And in verse 11, they praised the Lord. They praised Yahweh because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. And the excitement that would have come at that time. You know what it's like in ecclesial projects. Those of you that have been involved in building ecclesial halls or any kind of project that we get in, we get excited. You've done all this planning. We've got all the things ready to go. You might plan a seminar. You might plan an activity for your ecclesia. And it maybe takes months to plan. And now everything's ready. And finally you get to do it. Sometimes doing Bible schools is like that. When the Bible school finally comes, all those that have planned and planned, and it finally comes about, and we thank God, we get excited that it's finally happening. But look what happened in verse 12. Many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses, who were old men, who had seen the first temple, they wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shouting of the joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard afar off. Yeah, those Samaritans are going to start hearing what's going on down there. But here we are at a time in ecclesial life where the foundation of the temple is finally being laid, and the workers are out there, and everybody's finally doing what they prepared for. But you know, there's a mixed spirit in the community. The folks that had been around and had seen the previous temple, they looked at this one and they couldn't get excited about it. They remembered what Solomon's temple had looked like. They remembered the former temple. They remembered the grandeur that had been in that temple. Maybe it was bigger, although it's hard to tell, because when you look at the dimensions, some people have just thought that maybe this was just a small temple. But when the dimensions are actually given in Cyrus's decree, which you don't get in Ezra chapter 1, but they're pulled out when the decree is found in Ezra chapter 6. For those of you that like to take little notes and make mention of things, in Ezra 6 at verse 3, when they found the decree later on, Cyrus had put into his decree that the foundations be firmly laid in verse 3 of chapter 6, and its height, or in other words, its length, as to how far it would go, was 60 cubits, and its width, 60 cubits. So he originally, when he made the decree to build this house of God in Jerusalem, Cyrus evidently put a limit on how big it could get. He didn't want the project getting out of control because a lot of it was being paid for from the treasuries. And so he said, let the limit be 60 cubits by 60 cubits. That was how big it could be. That would be bigger than Solomon's temple if they really did build it that big. We don't really know how big they built this temple, but it may be that it wasn't because of size. It may be that the older folks had just seen the glory, the gold, the silver, all the things that had gone into the original temple. And they remembered what it used to look like, and they just couldn't get excited about this temple. And that's an unfortunate problem that you get sometimes in ecclesial life. That's one of the risks, brothers and sisters, of having the younger people involved in ecclesial life. It's a risk. Sometimes when the young folks get involved and they plan a seminar, they plan a witnessing activity, they plan a hall fix-up day, they plan something in CYC, they're doing Sunday school projects, maybe what they pull off isn't as good as it was 20 years ago. That's possible. And sometimes what we can do is we can sort of like squash the spirit of the younger people, because all we can do in all of our years, we compare it with what went on 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago. And we remember things that were better than what's happening today. But that's unfortunate, because these people were doing the best they could. They were just doing with what the resources that they had, and the enthusiasm that would have been generated by these younger people getting out to do the work. But it's unfortunate that as older folks, we got to be careful that we don't look back in the archives of our minds and remember, oh, I remember when we did this, and it was a lot better back then, and it was a lot better back then. And we sort of squash the spirit of the younger people who are trying their best to be enthusiastic and being involved in the work of the ecclesias today. And it's just a warning that comes up because, and in this case, you can see it's definitely a younger versus older problem, because the younger people would never have known what the original temple looked like. Those that had come back from the captivity, some of them did remember. Now, it's worth looking up. This comes up in both prophets that are going to get the people going again on building the temple later on. Both prophets mention this problem. So this was not just something that happened right now and then it disappeared after a few years. This is a problem that continued on through the entire building of this temple, from the foundations all the way up. You go to Haggai, because Zechariah and Haggai are the two prophets in Ezra chapter 5 that get the people motivated to get building again. But look what happens in Haggai 2. We'll get a chance maybe to look tomorrow at some of the other things that are in Haggai. But in Haggai 2, they're starting to build again on the house of God. They're starting to stir up the spirit. Haggai 2, we're in the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month. The word of the Lord comes to Haggai the prophet. He says, speak to Zerubbabel and Joshua and the remnant of the people, saying, verse 3, who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Yeah, you see it. Who's left who remembers it, what the former temple looked like? And how do you see this building going up now? Because now we're 20 years into the building. Almost 20 years, at least 14, 15 years into the building when Haggai writes this. So they'd laid the foundation, and when he writes this, we're like 15 years into the building. So the walls would have been going up, and the temple was beginning to take some shape. And he says, well, how do you see it now? In comparison with it, is it not as nothing in your eyes? Is that how you see it? You look at this, the work that we're doing right now, and you see this as nothing in your eyes? All you can do is despise. They despised it. So yet now, be strong, Zerubbabel, says the Lord. And be strong, Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, says the Lord, and work, for I am with you, says the Lord of hosts. And he tries to encourage the younger people, even if the older ones were looking at it and they saw it as nothing in their eyes, and it wasn't as good as what they had before. He tries to encourage these people that we have to make the most of what we have. We can't do something that we don't have the resources to do. We can't pull off activities. We can't build things that God has not given us the resources for. So we have to just make the most of what we can in our ecclesial life and in our family life and pray for God's help. And the exciting thing was, for I am with you, says Yahweh. He was with them. He was going to help them get this temple built. Now, look in Zechariah chapter 4, because Zechariah also deals with this issue. In Zechariah chapter 4. In fact, actually, just to see a little background to Zechariah 4, just pick up a couple of verses out of Zechariah 3. Remember the vision of the high priest, where the high priest Joshua is standing next to Satan, and the adversaries we're going to run into, these Samaritans, are trying to stop the building of the work. And so Michael stands up, we find in the reference in Jude that Brother Des is just looking at, and he says, "The Lord rebuke you." Well, the encouraging thing to Joshua, the high priest, was, Joshua in this case, he's called Joshua here, and look down in verse 8, and he says to Joshua, the high priest, "You and your companions who sit before you, for they are a wondrous sign. And behold, I'm bringing forth my servant the branch, for behold, the stone that I've laid before Joshua." Now, this stone that he's laid before Joshua, this is not the foundation stone. And a lot of times in our reference books, we mistake this. The foundation of this temple had already been built. We're 15 years into it. This stone is the capstone. It's the final stone that went up on the top, which brought down the pressures on the entire building and held it all together. "For I have laid it before Joshua, and upon the stone," in verse 9, "are seven eyes." Now, that's not upon in the sense that the seven eyes are not actually in the stone. The word in the Hebrew, the upon, is that they're upon and that they're looking on the stone. There are seven eyes that he sees. And the seven eyes, they've got their eyes fixed on this stone. They're watching over this capstone because this building is going to be finished. And the seven eyes are certainly the seven eyes, the angels of the Lord, the seven eyes that were watching. "And behold," he says in verse 9, "I will engrave its inscription, says the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity from the land in that one day." Now, in chapter 4 in Zechariah, he goes on to the vision about the lampstands. And the vision of the lampstands, where you have the two, the olive trees and the oils flowing in. And you know, the thrust of that vision is that it won't be by might and it won't be by our power, but it will be by God's Spirit that this temple gets finished. And that's the thrust in verse 6. "Not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, says the Lord, this will be accomplished." In verse 7, "Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you'll become a plain." He's going to wipe them out. "And he'll bring forth the capstone," there it is, "with shouts of grace, grace to it." That's the inscription that was on the capstone. And why not? Because it wasn't going to be by works. It was going to be by grace that God's house is finally built in the end. Not by the legalism of finding our own righteousness, but by shouts of grace, grace. And in verse 8, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands shall also finish it." It's going to get done. "Then you shall know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me to you. For who has despised the day of small things?" Who out there? Who's despised this day of small things? You see this temple maybe as small. You don't see it as a great thing. But I'll tell you this, he says, "For these seven, who were they? They were the seven eyes that were watching over the capstone, guaranteeing that it was going to go up. The eyes of the Lord that were out there, the angels that were making sure that all the events were happening in the land to finish this temple. You might despise the day of small things," he says, "but these seven, these angels that are out there, the eyes of the Lord, they're rejoicing to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. These are the eyes of the Lord which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth." Which takes you back to Zechariah 1 and the vision of the angels on the horses coming through and that bringing the land all to be at rest so that this temple could be finished. These angels are out there working day after day after day to get God's will accomplished and get his house built. They're out there trying their best in our lives, in our personal lives, and organizing the events in the political arena. The angels were excited about this house going up. And he says to them, "You might not think this is such a great thing, but I'll tell you, the angels of God up in heaven, they're rejoicing that this temple is going to be finished and it's going to be built. And they have been working and working and working to get everything ready to finish this house." And I'll tell you, if that isn't enthusiasm and excitement to get up and start working, what else is there? When the angels were pulling for them more than they were pulling for themselves. And that's the kind of heavenly host that we have, brothers and sisters, that's pulling for us today in our ecclesial life. So don't ever get this depressed and discouraged about stuff that's going on in the ecclesia. The good news is that we might find depressing times. We might find discouraging times. But the angels are constantly doing their best. They are out there working day after day, and their eyes are fixed on getting God's temple built. Well, the building of the temple, when you look at how long it actually took place, we're looking at about probably there were 6 years in the reign of Cyrus. Then his son Cambyses comes along, and there's about 8 years during his reign. Then there's a fellow we call the Pseudo-Smertus. He's the imposter who took over the throne for about 7 months. That's when all the political upheaval came. And that's when the angels had to go out and put the world at rest again so that they could finish this temple. And then we're in now into the second year of Darius when the temple would finally, the rebuilding of Zechariah and Haggai would take place. And they got everybody going again on building up this temple. So it took about 20 years to finish. 20 years. Now, the problem with the 20 years, brothers and sisters, is this. If you took the 70-year captivity from the time in which Daniel was, like, taken captive until the time in which the Jews came back into the land, it's Cyrus's decree, you can map out 70 years and figure, well, that's 70 years. Let's get going on the temple. But you see, there were also Bible students in this community who looked around and they thought, well, you know, maybe the 70 years wasn't supposed to start until the end of Zedekiah, when the Babylonians took Zedekiah, destroyed the temple at that point, and maybe the 70 years were supposed to start then, and really, it's the wrong time to be finishing this temple, because that was about 20 years later when that actually happened. So if you go with the early versus the late, you got about a 20-year window in there, which is interesting because you can see why people might have tried to justify the idea that, well, maybe this isn't the right time to be building this temple. So what happens in Ezra chapter 4 is on the heels of the discouraging weeping amongst the elders, in Ezra chapter 4, look at what develops now as they're building. They've got the foundation of the temple laid. The noise is heard afar off. The Samaritans realize something's going on in Israel, and they check it out. And in Ezra chapter 4 at verse 1, the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of Yahweh, the God of Israel. And they come to Zerubbabel and Jeshua, and they say, hey, we want to help you out. We want to help too. You know, we've heard about this. Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. And we've sacrificed to him ever since the days of either Hadad, the king of Assyria, who brought us here. Because remember what the Assyrians would do is when they would take people and they would conquer a nation, they would remove the people from their land and they would scatter them in all these different places amongst their empire, because their strategy was that the way you control an empire is to divide everybody all up. And if we divide them all up, they can't unite against us, and that's the way we'll control them. And that's what happened when the northern kingdom went and they brought in, Azar Hadden and others brought in others and settled them up in the land. And this is the background for the Samaritans in the New Testament, when Jesus would go out and he would talk to Samaritans, or when the gospel went out to the Samaritans. And you can see why the Jews felt with Samaritans, they're not really Christadelphians. And they weren't. They weren't. And it's a good example right here of how you can look at, and sometimes, you know, in drawing lines. Drawing lines are important, as Brother Des was saying in the second class there, when you start looking in the last days, of how we can establish the guidelines for our ecclesias. So look at what happens. Now the challenge is set before Zerubbabel and Jeshua. What are we going to do about these Samaritans? Actually, a good Bible verse, if you want some background to the Samaritans, it would be to go back and mention, put in the reference right here, of 2 Kings 17, verses 28 to 40. There's a good section in there about the background to the Samaritans. Let's just see like what actually happened back then. And you can see that what they did when the Assyrians would bring people in, they would bring these people in that would have all their gods. So you'd have gods from all these different nations coming up into the northern kingdom. And so in verse 32, you see what happened is they feared Yahweh, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. And in verse 33 back then, they feared Yahweh, yet they served their own gods according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried away. And to this day, they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow his statutes or their ordinances, or the law and the commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. So you find that in the summary verse of that chapter, down at verse 40 and 41, that what ended up happening is these nations feared Yahweh, but they served their carved images. And that's the way that the Samaritans are left. So these Samaritans, on the surface, you see, they could say, oh, we serve Yahweh. We sacrifice to Yahweh, your God. But they also had all their pagan idols that they would use as well. It was a mixture of truth and error. These people weren't really Christadelphians at all. They just simply knew some of the things that the believers back then knew about, and they found out a little about their God, and they would worship their God and your God and this other God, and it just became a mixture and a hodgepodge of all the different gods up there in this northern area of the northern kingdom where these Samaritans were settled. So here's the challenge. And you can see this would be really a critical time when Joshua and Zerubbabel and the leaders of the community would have to sit down and talk this out. Should we have the Samaritans help us build? What do you think? Now, it was okay back in chapter 3. Nobody minded sending money up to Tyre and Sidon and buying supplies from other peoples. That was not a problem. But when it came time to build God's house, was it appropriate to have these people who worshiped Yahweh and other gods be a part of the building of this house? You can imagine there would have been a lot of good arranging meetings at that time, a lot of good discussions, a lot of debate on both sides of should we have them, shouldn't we have them involved. But you can see what they decided. Joshua and Zerubbabel in verse 3, look at what they said. You may do nothing with us to build a house for our God, for we alone will build to Yahweh, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. Now, you see what he did? They had made their decision. They're going to go with the Samaritans aren't going to be involved. Because this was a moral decision for the Jews. But when it came time to explain to the Samaritans, they needed more than just Jewish moral decision as to why you can't be involved. So they went back to Cyrus's decree and they said, remember what Cyrus told us? He said, all of us who were up here in Babylon, we were the ones who were supposed to come down and build this house to Yahweh on behalf of Cyrus. An interesting strategy, because they couldn't use their own moral decision. They had to come up with something where Cyrus, where the kingdom was involved, and they had the authority of Cyrus, and so that's what they did. And which was a good answer to give at that time. You know, it's probably they had some good discussions to figure out what they were going to say. So they came up, and there's the first test. The first test, now that they're getting going on the temple, is, are they going to go back to mixing with the peoples of the lands and bringing in the other gods with them, which was the very thing that had caused the destruction of the temple and the captivity in the first place? And here the angels are bringing this right into their test, right into their lives right now, right from the beginning, and God's going to test them right now. Did you learn anything from the captivity? Have we learned from our experiences? And this is exactly what the angels do to our lives today. They're constantly throwing things at us like this to find out, have we learned from past experience? Did we learn anything from what we went through, from the last trial, from the last problem? Have we learned? Are we ready to stand up and make that decision on behalf of our God? And they passed the test. They did it exactly right. But look in verse 4. Look what happens now. Now the people of the land, these are the Samaritans, what they did instead, because you won't let us play, We're going to cause trouble. They tried to discourage the people of Judah. They troubled them in the building. They went right after the enthusiasm that was going on in the building, and they probably caused problems for them. And this is going on over 15 years. 15 years this goes on, from the 6 years that they're working in the time of Cyrus into his son Cambyses. You're going through, it's almost like a 15-year period where this is actually happening. Now, for those of you that kept the handout the first day, the big white sheet? The big white page? See, I should have waited until today to hand that out. The white page has on it the kings of Persia lined up for you in order as to how they came, and some of the key events that take place here in Ezra, really in chapter 4, is where a lot of these are coming about. The temple actually started back here around 536 in the reign of Cyrus, after they had got back in the land. And so you get about the last 6 years of Cyrus where they were working. There's about 6 years where they worked in his life. And then his son Cambyses takes over when Cyrus had been killed in his Afghanistan campaign. So Cambyses' son takes over for about another 8 years. What's happening during this 8 years and that 6 years, this 14, 15-year period, is that the Samaritans are just whittling away at the Jews. They're just constantly, they're hiring people against them. They're causing problems. They might have been raiding their land. They might have been threatening to hurt their families. In whatever way they could, they were wearing out the people of Israel. And they were wearing them down. You see in verse 5, they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose. All the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, even unto the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. Now, you see, here's Darius coming in. Darius starts right here at 521. So they did this. They frustrated him over this whole 15-year period in there. And they just constantly wore them down and wore them down and wore them down. And the enthusiasm that the younger folks started with, that enthusiasm that they had started generating, it started going down, down, down. And you know, that's what we experience too sometimes, brothers and sisters, in the trials of our lives, in ecclesial life, where we get going in a project, we get a witnessing camp going, and seminars are rolling, we get everybody out leafleting, and we hold the seminars, and then over time, as it goes on and on and on, and we have contacts and follow-up work to do, the interest just starts to go lower and lower and lower sometimes in ecclesial life. And sometimes there's problems that develop in our homes and our families and the problems in ecclesia where we get whittled away at and whittled away at, and we lose that enthusiasm that we had to start with. And they frustrated them for these 14, 15 years. And what happens in ecclesial life when we get frustrated? If we're not doing God's work, what do? We get frustrated. We're not going to go to Bible class anymore. We're not going to teach Sunday school next year. I'm not going to be involved in the witnessing campaigns. And we're just not going to show up as often to meeting anymore. And what happens over time is we start focusing in on our life, our career, our house, and we start doing all these things around our little home and our little house, and we leave God's ecclesia out there on the sidelines because we got frustrated. And that was what was happening in this time. It's so true to human life. We all know, you experience these kind of things in our life. And over 15 years, they got worn out. They just got worn out and worn out. So that Haggai would have to come along when he gives his prophecy and he says, what's the matter with you folks living in your paneled houses while God's house over there lies in ruins? That's what they'd been doing, working on their own place, fixing up their own home, moving maybe from house to house, getting the bigger house, redoing the house, and this kind of stuff. And the work of God was just thrown in the corner because they got worn out. And you can see how that would happen. But that's the challenge, you see. When things are going bad, we can't let that get us down. We need people in the ecclesia that stir us back up. We need husbands and wives that remind us when we get discouraged, get back out there and get involved. Sometimes it takes our children that are growing up and they say they want to go out to Bible class, and they get moms and dads motivated to get back involved in the truth. But you know, listen to those things. Those are the things where the angels are driving us back into God's work and trying to get us started again in the work that we should be doing. Now, there's an interesting section here in Ezra chapter 4, starting around at verse 6. Now, we just got at verse 5 that they frustrated him all the days until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. This is one of the areas in verse 6 where you'll see that Christadelphian writers diverge at this point, and they don't all agree on what's happening, nor do outside commentaries on the history that's happening here in Ezra chapter 4. So, in the beginning of the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. Now, I'll just mention to you that Ahasuerus, just so you know, the reason you got the longer line on your little handout, if you look up here for a second, see, he just said that it frustrated him all the time to the reign of Darius, which would be this Darius Hystaspes right here, back in verse 5. And now it mentions this fellow, now in the reign of Ahasuerus, at the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation. Some of our Christadelphian writers have thought that the Ahasuerus was the next guy, Xerxes. He's the one who comes in after Darius Hystaspes. And then they think that Artaxerxes Longimanus comes in later on in this chapter, because it mentions then in verse 7, and in the days of Artaxerxes also, Bisham and Mithridates and so on, they wrote, and the rest of their companions, they wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and here's what they wrote. But I don't think that fits the context, and nor do some of the others. I was looking at Brother H.P. Mansfield's stuff on this years ago, and it seems to make a lot more sense if you understand that verse 5 was that they frustrated him all these years, and he gives us a little summary at the beginning, and then he goes back and recaps and says, now, here's what they really did. In the reign of Ahasuerus, now, our Bible calls him Ahasuerus, but this is actually Cyrus' son, Cambyses, right here. Because the temple's finished in the sixth year of Darius right here, and it's all done. So why in the world would he be talking about kings way on down the line when Ezra chapter 4 is all about the finishing of the temple? It's the temple. So we know it has to end by the sixth year of Darius. So this fellow who's called Ahasuerus in verse 6 is actually Cambyses. And all these are his titles. They're just things like king and ruler and so on. They're not somebody's actually specific name. So that's Cambyses. And in his day, they wrote an accusation. But you see, Cambyses, he didn't do anything. They wrote an accusation, but he knew his dad Cyrus had said, let him build the temple. And so it went on. But then, in verse 7, in the days of Artaxerxes also, then you see what happens. Bisham and Meredith and Tabiel and the rest of their companions, they write to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and their letter was written in verse 7 in the Aramaic script and translated into the Aramaic language, and here is what they write. Now, we don't have time to go through the whole letter, but the gist of the letter is, they write this letter and they say, look it. Verse 12, you see, we want to make sure the king realizes that these Jews who came up from you up there and have come to us at Jerusalem, they're building the rebellious in that evil city and they're finishing its walls and repairing its foundations. Now, see, they make it sound like they're building the walls around the city when really they were just working on the temple. But let it be known, verse 13, to the king, that if this city is built and the walls are completed, they won't pay the tax or the tribute or the custom, and the king's treasury will be diminished. So you see how they're trying to throw all these things they can find about, if you don't take care of this, these people are going to rebel. You're going to lose money. This is going to look bad. And if they get away with it, imagine what it will do through the rest of the kingdom. Everybody will start rebelling from you. Now, what's really interesting is how the angels orchestrated all this. When you go back and look in the history of this whole time period right here, it's going to give you some of the background. I found this fascinating. I'm indebted a lot to Brother Mansfield and some of the others that have followed up on this and looked at how this worked. And some of the other history books, there's some commentaries that have this as well. I'm sure that's where he got it from. But when you look at what really happened, Cyrus's son was Cambyses, and Cambyses had all the authority that Cyrus had. He's ruling over Persia. Yes, he did have to take a few years to settle some of the problems that had developed. But after Cambyses, here's what happened. If you look back in the history of the Persian kings, Cambyses was out on a campaign after his 8-year reign, and he died on his campaign. This fellow here, Cambyses II, he was the son of Cyrus the Great. When he died on the campaign, he either killed himself, either committed suicide, or somebody killed him, somebody within his ranks. Something went on in the kingdom where he's dead, and we don't really know exactly in the records as to how it actually happened. But what happened back in the capital is one of the magi who was frustrated with the magi were some of the religious rulers and the priests that were there back in the Persian kingdom. They were frustrated with the direction that the kingdom was going and how they were giving so much freedom to all these foreigners to go and build all these temples in other places, because Cyrus didn't just do this for the Jews. He did this for other nations as well. He wasn't just a Jewish, somebody who was really into the Jews. He was sending back all these different people that had been gathered up in the land, sending them back and hoping they would build temples for him and pray for him and pray for him that his kingdom would be really good. So he was really doing it for himself. But what happened right here when Cambyses died, the Magi put forward one of them who probably claimed to be this other son over here of Cyrus, this Bardia. He's known in the historical records, he's called Gomedes, he's called Smyrta, he's given all these different names, but he was a pseudo-king. That's why I like to call him the pseudo-Smyrtus, is the way a lot of people refer to him as. He claimed to be the king. He claimed to be the brother over here, and he thought he had the rights of the king. And the Magi put him forward and said, you get in there and rule now, and we'll be all set. In fact, they may have actually been the ones that orchestrated the death of Cambyses when he was out on the campaign. So you look at this in terms of like what the angels were doing in the political situation. The people back in the land were getting frustrated. They were getting worn out, the believers back in the land that were working. They were getting frustrated, and they were starting to say, well, why should we build this temple? Why, all the signs are against us. It looks like it's not going real well. Why don't we start working on our own homes? Let's get going on our careers. Let's get our farmlands going. And they gave up on working on the temple. And as time went on, and they got more and more discouraged, and things were frustrated, in the end, God gave them exactly what they were doing. He gave them exactly what they wanted. And he said in the end, you got to stop. Now, it's an interesting concept that the angels that were trying to get this temple built realized that the people were getting frustrated. They lost their enthusiasm to work in the Lord. They wanted to work on their own homes. They wanted to do all these other things. So in the end, what he does is he changes the political arena in such a way that he removes the king, puts in a fake king. The fake king had, oh, he was scared stiff. Here he is now in charge of the kingdom. People realize he was an imposter. And other nations, as soon as they realized that the Cambyses had died on the campaign, other nations were going to rebel around the area. And it was a great time for nations to rebel from Persia. And this guy is scared stiff, who our Bible calls Artaxerxes in Ezra chapter 4 at verse 7. So when the letter came up from these folks down in these Samaritans down there, and the letter comes up and says, don't you realize what's going on? If you let them finish, they're not going to pay the tax. They're going to rebel. If they rebel, other people will rebel. This fellow was scared stiff. And immediately he sends a letter back down and says, stop the work. That's it. You're done. And God gave the people what they wanted. And you know, sometimes in life, brothers and sisters, God does that to us. When we make decisions in life over time, we get frustrated in family life and in ecclesial. And we end up going down a pathway where we're turning away from God. That there are times where God may just give us what we want. He removes. He takes away opportunities that we have. He allows us to go down a pathway until we get so far removed that maybe someday we'll look back and realize, wow, I can't believe how far away I got. And then at that point, he can draw us back. But in this case, that's to these people. They had spent time on the wrong things, and the king sends back the answer in verse 7. Of Ezra chapter 4, he sends back an answer to Rahab the commander, Shimshai the scribe, peace and so forth, at the end of verse 17. The letter which you sent has been read clearly to us before me. I gave the command, search to be made, found that the city in 5 times has made insurrection against the kings, and sedition entered in it. So in 21, I'll give to make these men cease, that the city may not be built until command is given by me. Now take heed to what you do, and do not fail to do this. For why should damage increase to the herd of the sheep? And so in verse 23, the sad community was that when the copy was read, they made haste. They couldn't wait. Here come all the Samaritans, and here they go. They come up to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms, they made them cease. And thus the word in the house of Jerusalem ceased, was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Unfortunately, you know, you have to leave it for right now. And that's what it happened in life. Our warning, brothers and sisters, for today is that we've got to be careful that when things are going wrong in ecclesial life or in our family life, those that are younger people, maybe things aren't going well with mom and dad, or maybe things with mom and dad aren't going well between mom and dad. And things are happening where we're being tested and frustrated in what's going on. We have to constantly be back to the Word, remind ourselves and surround ourselves with people and get involved in projects in ecclesial life that will constantly bring us back to the right things. What tends to happen over time is that we slowly drift away. As Paul said to the Hebrews in chapter 2, we got to pay earnest attention to these things lest we slowly drift away. Boat on the lake, and you just drift away a little bit this week, a little more next month, and a little more next year, and we drift so far away that we're not involved anymore because of the frustrations that we were experiencing at the time. And this can happen where we get frustrated in life, and we just sort of want to give up, and we get discouraged. So this is where the test of our faith comes in, is in the midst of trouble, which is really the second test that these Jews had to look at, is one thing to take to survive the test. Are we going to go back to paganism and worship these gods, the very problem that had caused the captivity and the fall of the temple in the first place? But now the second test was, which is what God's looking for, is now that we got through that one, are we ready to endure? Endurance. It's such a simple concept, but when troubles come up in life, when things aren't going well, when it looks like there are roadblocks set family or our ecclesia, are we going to continue in the work of the Lord or are we going to back off? And that's a challenging thing we all experience. And it's sometimes you think, well, I'd never give up. You know, I'm never going to, you know, you got all that enthusiasm as younger people and you think, I'm ready to endure and here we go. But some of the people out here, we know that over time, things wear us down, don't they? Problems in families wear us down. Raising children sometimes wears us down. Problems in social life, and when we knock heads with people, things aren't going well. Those frustrations can wear us down. And we can't make decisions this week at school. What are we going to do when we get home? How are we going to keep from letting those things wear us down? And some of the things that is sound activities. Get back. Maybe people want to be doing right away. But get involved in another area. It's not that we're involved in. Like maybe you're involved in a committee that's involving in witnessing and it's not working out there. Get involved in landscaping at your hall. Get involved in some other kind of work. Get involved in pastoral work. Pastoral work. We're always hungry for brothers and sisters that will be involved in pastoral work. It's so difficult. Need to be involved. This is the way that God keeps the ecclesia, helping us to knock off those edges and stones that will right in those stones into His temple in the new age. Being involved in ecclesial life, getting involved, and if there's something that we don't like and we don't like any of the projects, especially as younger people, if you find there isn't for you to do, create something new, come up with a new idea that's never been done before. And try something different. I remember at a we were at where some, we were just talking with some folks about what they did. And they told us that what they were doing in their ecclesia, they started a thing. They had a lot of young people, a lot of young families, and they decided in their midweek Bible class, instead of just having a class for adults and parents, they decided to run like Sunday school at their midweek class. There were enough children to do that. And we were looking back thinking, well, we've got a lot of kids at home. And maybe we should do something like that. And you're wondering, kids really come out Wednesday night or Tuesday night or whatever night you have your Bible class? Will kids really come out on that night to a Bible class? Will parents really bring them? And much to our surprise, we started with one class, and it's grown, and it's grown, and now multiple ecclesias are doing it. They get these projects, and they were building a tabernacle at their Bible class. And the kids were really excited and involved. And I'll tell you, to my surprise, brothers and sisters, you wouldn't be surprised. You'd think, well, some of the older ones might think, well, that's going to take away from you. You're going to have adults that are going to be involved in teaching children, and there won't be as many adults at the class. What we found in our ecclesia is that the attendance of the adults went up because the kids were bringing their parents to come to Bible class. It's amazing how that sometimes works. But it was totally not what we expected, but that it just worked out really well. But that was something that had been done in our area before that younger people can do. And those are the kind of Bible school this week. Talk to people. Find out, what are you doing in your ecclesias? What kind of activities are working? What are you trying that's new? Look how the seminars have caught on because some brethren put that together in Ohio. Look at how well that's working. Talk to people. Find out what works. And go home and implement something new in your ecclesia that maybe has never been done before. Nobody can say this is great because nobody else has been doing that right now. Or maybe it was done ago and it isn't being done right now. But those are the ways, brothers and sisters, we can try to ward off the tendency to get the truth involved. And we leave today with the sad part, believe it, is that discouragement had set in, frustrated political situation, a king to be for only 7 months, and he decrees and says, you cannot do it anymore, and they're by force of the king, and everything that allowed them to do was over. It went on forever. It was only Darius for the work got going again. You can see the importance of having a Haggai and a Zechariah come on the scene and